this policy, it's not simply about the concentration of CO2 and methane in the atmosphere. It's about the whole carbon cycle. We actually want to regenerate the living portion of the carbon cycle, the biosphere, as much as possible, and communities. Because if you don't have coherent, stable communities that can regenerate and coherent, stable ecosystems, those stores of carbon will eventually become unstable. If you have a society that breaks down, you know, law and governance breaks down, you might end up with violence and confusion and an inability to maintain public services, and that could release huge amounts of carbon. We need to broaden our horizon about what actually we are talking about. It's the living carbon cycle as well as the concentration of gases in the atmosphere.
Hello and welcome to Planet Critical, the podcast for a world in crisis. My name is Rachel Donald. I'm a climate corruption journalist and your host. Every week I interview experts who are battling to save our planet. My guests are scientists, politicians, academics, journalists, and activists. They explain the complexities of the energy, economic, political, and cultural crises we face today, revealing what's really going on and what they think needs to be done. These are the stories of the big picture. Go to planetcritical.com to learn more and subscribe. My guest this week is Delton Chen. Delton is a civil engineer and a geohydrologist. He's also the founder of Global Carbon Reward, a new global policy for managing climate-related risk. Delton joined me to walk me through Global Carbon Reward. And this conversation is fascinating. It's technical, it's nuanced, it's broad, it's about politics and economy and energy and corruption. And I really, really enjoyed it. Delton really patiently walks me through the technical details behind this policy, including some of the mechanisms of the financial market, such as exchange rates, trading, floor prices, the role of central banks, etc. And he does this to lay out the model of the global carbon reward, which he says is a carrot policy. It's a financial incentive for polluting industries to absolutely reduce their carbon emissions and for the private sector to invest in the research, development, and deployment of mitigation technologies. Delton begins by walking us through the carbon cycle of the planet and why creating an economy that reflects that carbon cycle, what he calls a photosynthesis economy, is critical to managing overall planetary well-being. He then walks us through the policy, and we stop at almost every step to tease out some of the technical details, and also for me to challenge certain points, like carbon dioxide removal technology, perverse incentives in the current economic model, techno-optimism versus techno-realism, political corruption, and the power hierarchies on which this system thrives. What Delton's proposing is a market-based solution, and I do think there is a strain of idealism in what he has proposed. However, the model looks really good, and it leads to a lot of really interesting conversations around human behavior, expectation, geopolitics, degrowth, and leadership. I hope you all enjoy the episode. If you do, please share it far and wide. And if you're loving the show, support Planet Critical with a paid subscription at planetcritical.com. By signing up, you'll get the Planet Critical newsletter inspired by each episode delivered straight to your inbox every week. You'll also have access to the wonderful Planet Critical community, who are full of inspiring thoughts, ideas, critiques, and determination. I'm so grateful to everyone who chooses to support the project. I'm a vehement believer in ad-free and open-access content, so Planet Critical wouldn't exist without the direct support of the amazing community. Thank you so much to all of you who believe in Planet Critical and keep the project going every week. Delton, thank you very much for joining me on Planet Critical. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you, Rach.
My first question for you before we dive in to what you've joined me to discuss today is, why is the world in crisis?
Yes, well, the world definitely is in crisis. It's in crisis, obviously, over climate and sustainability more generally. And, you know, I don't really need to explain it. I think all of our viewers would have some idea. My work and my speciality is the climate problem. And when I look at climate change and planetary boundaries and resource limits, I'm looking at this problem through the lens of the carbon cycle. So I actually see this problem of climate change is not so much being just the carbon balance, the carbon budget, the Paris goals, but achieving a systemically safe carbon cycle, which includes all components of it. So obviously that would include the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but it also includes the acidity of the oceans and the store of carbon in the biosphere, which includes also not just biodiversity, but DNA and biomass, soil carbon, and all the complexity of life, including the food web itself, which is a system. And so I think that's a much more holistic way to look at the climate problem, the climate crisis, and it also relates to planetary boundaries as well. So if you look at the planetary boundaries, indeed, most of them are actually strongly related to the carbon cycle. Climate change, the link is clear. It's carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases. But biodiversity, all biodiversity is carbon-based. Then the climate impacts the hydrological cycle. So it affects freshwater systems, it affects land use, and it also affects nitrogen and phosphorus. Because N and P are coupled to carbon in a stoichiometric ratio in the biological world, in the biosphere. So there are many reasons to look at this problem in terms of the carbon cycle and not simply just the bathtub model for the atmosphere. And this is a crisis because we have a paradigm in economics that is focused on Arthur Pigou's theory as the standard theory or default theory, which looks at this problem through the lens of the social cost. And my claim is that we're in a climate crisis because that theory, although it's a good theory, it's not broad enough to take into account the systemic risks that we face, which are related to the carbon cycle. And these risks include the upstream risks of political gridlock, the political gridlock lack of action that's related to the financial system, in my opinion. And it's also related to the downstream tipping points and positive feedbacks and cascading effects in Earth systems. So if you look at this problem through the lens of systemic risk, in addition to Pigou's social cost, we can begin to see the problem is much bigger than what economists see through the standard theory. So I think that's a pretty good start. There are other problems too that we have to face, including things like weapons of mass destruction in World War III and God knows what else. But these are the main points that I focus on.
It's a huge amount of points, and I'm always really excited to speak to somebody whose work manages to encompass all of these sorts of things, because really what we need are new systems of understanding the world and how to engage with it that are complex and dynamic. I suppose before we move on to the global carbon reward, could you also reference how resource limitations, which you mentioned in the beginning, also play a part in this picture? Is that one of the downstream risks?
Did you say resource limitations?
Yes.
Well, resource limitations are part of the problem, but that's quite a nuanced problem, actually. So, for example, there are people who talk about limits to metals and rare earth metals, minerals that are needed for the clean energy transition. I think that's a topic you've covered in other podcasts. That's a good example of a resource limit. And that does add to the systemic risk, but it's a problem more about economics and how to manage resource scarcity, because the way prices work, they tend to encourage substitution. And technology can address substitution. So resource limits are a bit flexible. If indeed we do reach hard limits of some critical resources, perhaps something like phosphorus, nutrient for growing crops, then that is a kind of restrictive limit that has an analogy in ecosystems. So ecosystems that are nutrient poor, they just adapt to that environment by recycling nutrients. And that's what we would have to do. But resource...
If I may here, though. These are hard limits. So these aren't economic problems. I mean, the UN just released a report a few weeks ago that said that if the world were to decarbonize, we would see an increase in our mining globally by 60%, which would have terrible knock-on effects to climate, both locally and globally. And so the writers of this UN report called for degrowth.
Yes, that's a really important and complex point. So I'll try and answer that or speak to that topic, because it is a very important topic. But I'll just make one point before we go into those to that report. I've only had a quick look at it because it came out recently. But I just want to point out that if we look at carbon as a resource, there's something very special about carbon in that it naturally recycles. That's the carbon cycle. It naturally goes into the atmosphere as CO2. It's drawn down again through photosynthesis, and then it's respired out or combusted. And so the important point about carbon is that as the building block of life, it doesn't really have a resource limit per se. Now, the other resources that that report was talking about, which are finite, that's a serious problem. So there's no magic solution for resource limits. But I think the question is, how do we manage our economy so that we don't over-extract to cause some incredible impact on the environment? Now, I can't actually answer the question for all resources, because the work I'm doing, as I said, it looks at carbon and the carbon cycle. But I will make this point. I do believe that civilization, it won't survive, or certainly won't prosper and thrive, if it doesn't have the economy or the economic structure to deal with carbon first. So the point being is that life itself, including ecosystems as a whole, they naturally recycle carbon, and we'd have to follow that model, that analogy. Once we can manage carbon through the economy, then we would begin to deal with the various other elements that have finite supply, like phosphorus, for example, phosphates. There are other minerals that have finite supply, more or less. Maybe I can't name them, but, you know, silver is quite finite. I'm sure there are many others. But I don't think our survival necessarily is dependent on any one of those resources if it were to be diminished. So
please don't apologize. If I may, our survival depends on energy, like every other sort of biological organism in the world. And we have incredibly complex, infrastructurally complex societies now that demand huge energy resources. And so either we are going to have to substitute fossil fuel infrastructure for renewable infrastructure, which we're not going to be able to do in time, and should not be done on the scale, from what I understand, that fossil fuel infrastructure currently exists, because the energy demands plus material demands would be catastrophic for the Earth's crust, quite frankly, because of everything that we have to be pulling out. So I understand what you're saying about carbon being the building block, and we will get into this very, very quickly, the global carbon reward. But I just want to keep bringing back to also this holistic understanding that everything is fundamentally finite on a finite planet, surely. And anything that provides us with energy, whether that is, you know, biological organisms like plants, vegetables, you know, meat, other animals, or the infrastructure that is heating our homes and keeping us alive through winter. It's all critical.
Yes. I understand what you're saying, and it's a very deep question, actually. It's a deep and challenging philosophical dilemma. So I'll try to address this in a scientific way, but without giving all the details. Please don't accept this answer as some kind of complete proof, which it isn't. But if we consider that life itself, ecosystems, they are more or less self-sustaining over long periods of time. What they do need is sunlight to power photosynthesis. So if we frame our civilization in a similar model, then we could supplement that possibly with maybe nuclear fusion or fission. But other than that, that's the boundary upon which we would have to survive. So the economic model, which is not yet published, but the economic model, I call it the living systems economy. What it does is it considers our consumptive economy as analogous to respiration and combustion. But in the biological world, it's respiration. And then we need to build a parallel economy, if you like, which is analogous to photosynthesis. Now, there is a relationship between the photosynthesis and the respiration in the biological world, in ecosystem, and in symbiosis in organisms themselves. And that is, energy is transferred from the photosynthesizing systems into the respiring systems, either through the provision of sugars, through feeding, or symbiosis. So by analogy, that's what our policy would do. It transfers energy as required, but it goes the other way. It doesn't come from the photosynthesis into the respiration, because in our civilization, the system is set up differently. We'd have to transfer the energy from the respiring superorganism into the photosynthesizing superorganism. And by doing that, and also by decarbonizing both systems, it would eventually converge onto what people might call net zero or net negative at the macro level. So I have explained this in some draft papers. It's a little tricky to explain in an interview, but that's the basic model. And for people who are interested in this approach, I recommend you look at control system theory. So people aren't talking about control system theory, which is quite remarkable given the predicament we're in. But control system theory is actually a very robust and extremely well-tested model for regulating processes and outcomes. So just historically speaking, the first control systems were invented more than 2,000 years ago in ancient Greece with water clocks. And then there was another innovation, the centrifugal governor in the steam engine. You would have heard of James Watt's steam engine and so on, that helped launch the first industrial revolution. So the control system, what it does is it takes information from the environment and then it regulates the process so that it doesn't go too hot or too cold or too fast or too slow. And by comparison, what we would actually need is a control system to regulate our emissions globally and the rate at which we draw carbon out of the atmosphere. So I know it's a big ask. I'm not saying that this is going to magically happen and it's going to be easy. But unless you have the meta system solution, unless you have a macro economic policy, it's simply not going to happen on its own. Because as you could imagine, our civilization has a lot of inertia and it's heading towards this dirty growth trajectory. It's not sustainable. So we need a structural reform. Now, it's interesting about control system theory because indeed, almost every machine and tool or computer that we have in the modern world has control systems in them to regulate them. You know, even an air conditioner will have a control system if it's running on a thermostat. So this is the macro model that the global carbon reward actually constructs. Now, for this to make sense, I can give you an example. So the classic carbon tax that comes from Arthur Bagoo's theory, it actually is a control system design. It's just that the economists haven't figured that out. So the way it works is the economists collect information about the economy. They run it through computers to calculate or estimate the social cost of carbon. So that's your information. And then that feeds back to the carbon tax that's supposed to rise over time to internalize the social cost of carbon and correct the market failure. Now, that is by definition a control system. However, there's a major problem with that classical model. And that is that the carbon tax simply doesn't work because it's not able to solicit cooperation from society because the financial system is too heavily biased towards profit. And the carbon tax is resisted politically because it challenges that profit motive that's needed to pay down debt. And this is why the carbon tax, even though it does meet the criteria of a control system, it just doesn't work. It's not a non-functional control system. So the global carbon reward is a complement to it, which introduces a second control system that does actually solicit cooperation, and it circumvents that debt problem in the financial system to solicit cooperation. So this concept, this meta system solution, I call it the living systems economy, if you're interested in systems, it has the quality of a control system that can regulate the flow of finance explicitly for removing carbon from the atmosphere and reducing emissions in various ways until we reach a carbon balance that's safe and a carbon cycle that's relatively safe and regenerative. So that's the framework. And I believe only from that framework can we ever actually have a chance of becoming sustainable in the long term. And that's with regards to all the other minerals and resources and problems of pollution, like plastic pollution, and it just goes on and on. So I might just pause and let you speak because that's quite a lot of information.
So just quickly, is the global carbon reward a complement to a carbon tax, like works in tandem with a carbon tax, or could it be deployed on its own?
It can be deployed on its own, but it works best with the tax. In fact, it's supposed to be complementary to sticks. You can call it carrot and sticks if you like. That's the model, carrot and stick carbon pricing. This idea of using carrots and sticks together, it isn't simply an idea that came out of my head. There have been several studies that have looked into this phenomena of applying carrots and sticks to groups of people. And what they've found consistently is that when you do apply carrots and sticks, human cooperation does actually maximize. So what scientists found through game control experiments is that when they wanted the group of people when they wanted them to cooperate, they tried giving them incentives that were pure sticks and then pure carrots and then combinations. And they found that the sequence that was the most successful was actually to start with carrots and then bring in sticks second, and that maximized cooperation. Now, that's very interesting because if you look at what we're doing globally, we're doing the complete opposite. We're starting with sticks and we haven't moved properly onto carrots yet. We have some inkling of carrots with the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States and a splattering of subsidies here and there, but not a global carrot. The thesis and the theory behind the global carbon reward is that when we do introduce this global carrot, we'll see a massive increase in cooperation and it'll be a breakthrough. That's the hope. Not yet proven, but that's the concept.
So could you walk us through what the global carbon reward looks like policy-wise and the impact that you project it would have on everyone from people, communities, to corporations, to governments?
Sure. Maybe best if I begin with some examples. It is a big and rather complex policy, I have to admit. However, the complexity is necessary to deal with the complexity of our planet and our environment. So if you think of how complex our planet actually is, the biosphere, you need a mechanism or a policy that can match that in its decentralization. So what we would do is that we create a new institution under the UN, and it would have a mandate to issue a carbon asset. We call it a carbon currency. The name doesn't really matter, but a carbon asset digitally to projects that can reduce emissions and take carbon out of the atmosphere. And this also includes substituting fossil fuels with renewables, which is an important innovation. But the idea is that we can issue that as much as we need. Then the central bank...
And the carbon currency, or the carbon coin, would be issued when people succeed in taking carbon out of the atmosphere, either by reducing their amount of emissions or by offsetting.
Removing and reducing. They're really the two options. So
we're talking absolute reductions here.
Well, with reductions, that's another nuanced topic. We could go down that rabbit hole, but reductions of emissions, they will be measured in terms of actual reductions, but the pricing and reward for those reductions, conventional mitigation, will be very flexible under this policy. And that's because there is a very diverse range of industries and economic sectors that need to be rewarded. And so the policy is flexible for reductions. It has a lot of room for negotiation and maneuver to hit price points depending on location and industry. But with removals, that's commonly called carbon dioxide removal or negative emissions technologies, that particular activity is treated in a special way. That's given a universal or global explicit price signal, and the computations are based on the net removals from the atmosphere. Now, this might seem a little bit strange, but
I suppose that the thing that's flagging to me is that for the moment, CDR, carbon dioxide removal, is a technology that doesn't work. Is proving to be more expensive, and often building these kinds of plants emits more than they can ever hope to capture.
I'm glad you raised that point. It's a really important question, because that question is loaded with morality and governance problems. And what I believe is important is that the global carbon reward has a rational approach to address this very problematic issue. That is, you know, why would we want to trust in carbon dioxide removal when it currently doesn't go to scale for whatever reason? So the short answer is this. The policy aims to maximize conventional mitigation, which is the reductions that we're discussing. That means clean energy transition that's very rapid and accelerated. It means decarbonizing all the key sectors of the economy. What you do is you maximize that in a strategic way to get where we need to go. Now, once that project is underway and the world more or less recognizes we're running at top speed for reductions, conventional mitigation, then you metaphorically, you sit back and take in a deep breath. Then you look at what's going to happen in the future with regards to the carbon balance. There have been many studies on this particular topic, and they all come to the same conclusion, which is in the future, we're going to have residual emissions that are quite significant, simply because there are activities that are just very, very difficult to decarbonize. Now, if we accept that there will be at least a minimum amount of residual emissions, that's the amount that we target with the policy. Now, I'd like to talk to the notion of scalability and technology. So if you want to take the position that we must have those technologies today, the CDR, the NETS technologies, like show me how it works, that's an ideological position. The way I look at this problem of CDR and or NETS is that we're at a point in human history that's comparable to, say, aviation in 1903 with the Wright brothers' first manpower flight. Maybe not quite at that point, but let's say 10 or 15 years from that point, if we use aerospace as a comparison. So from the Wright brothers' first manpower flight in around 1903, I believe, to 100 years later, we had, by the year 2003, we've been to the moon. We have a space station. We have international aviation. You know, the technological progress there has been extraordinary. So if you kind of map that onto where we are today, basically we have a technological and thermodynamic challenge where we as a civilization have to become experts in carbon dioxide removal as quickly as possible. Now, if you want to do that, if you want to mobilize hundreds of billions of dollars into CDR for research and development to speed this up, a way to do that is to provide a guaranteed reward price for CDR. And that's what this policy actually does. It provides a long-term, 100-year rolling reward price that's guaranteed by central banks for CDR. With this price signal, what will happen is that the private sector will see the opportunity, because there's an opportunity to earn billions of dollars, and they will mobilize huge amounts of money into the research and development to obtain those technologies and refine those technologies. Now, as we talk about this problem, I think we need to be honest with ourselves in that if we compare it with aviation, there is a difference. So aviation had the problem of gravity to deal with, primarily. With CDR, the problem is not gravity. The problem is thermodynamics. There is an energy cost to take carbon out of the atmosphere. And so the challenge there is to overcome that energy barrier to take carbon out of the atmosphere, which is at low concentration, and to concentrate it, reduce its entropy down to a liquid, solid, or biomass that can be stored for long periods of time. Now, this problem, you can look at it in a defeatist mindset and say, oh, it's all too difficult. We don't have the answers today. But my advice is that this is actually the future for our civilization. The future of our civilization has to be tied up in managing the carbon cycle, if not as an evolutionary step change. Like some people like Nate Hagans and others are talking about the economy as a superorganism. So if we take that metaphor or analogy and you compare it to respiration, because how would you compare our civilization to respiration or photosynthesis? Well, it's obviously much closer to respiration, but we need another superorganism that can copy, emulate photosynthesis, but in ways that make sense for our predicament with the carbon cycle.
There are things that I think we need to tease out in this, and we will go back to the Global Carbon Reward. I promise. But to me, it does sound like techno-optimism rather than techno-realism, because I think that to compare where we are now with, to compare it with aviation, CDR, I think that's misleading, because when the Wright brothers were working on that, and when, you know, the sort of world followed in suit to enjoy this huge boom, which is sort of what defines the 20th century, especially after World War II, right? huge breakthroughs are being made all of the time. It's scientific progress, medical progress, civil rights progress. Like, it was the century, in a sense, of progress, because we'd had sudden sort of access to a huge amount of energy, materials, and certainly the global north were exploiting the resources and the labor from the global south. So it was a lot of essentially nigh on free energy entering the system as well. We are not seeing those breakthroughs right now, generally. This is something that when I speak to scientists, there's this consensus that, like, there's no eureka moments. It's almost as if humankind has had most of its eureka moments, the ones that it can kind of access. Like, everything's becoming really detailed and complex, and things are taking time. We're not making these massive leaps and bounds that we were in the past. And so I think the fact that sort of the rate of, let's call it the rate of leap and bound progress has slowed, and also factor in the time that we are in an existential crisis, there is no guarantee that we will still have access to energy, even in sort of the 2030s into the 2040s. I mean, I interviewed somebody recently who him and his team had modeled oil depletion all around the world that isn't being spoken about. And in the North Sea, we're looking that we're going to run out in 2031. In Norway, it's going to be 2032. There are these really sudden shocks to the system that are on the horizon that we are rapidly running out of time to navigate. And so for me, relying on a technology that is going to take a huge amount of cooperation when it comes to supply chains, political cooperation, political will, all of these things, when for the moment we haven't seen those, to me, it is like pressing the foot down on the accelerator on a path that we know is heading towards destruction, rather than trying to steer around, in a sense. I'm very, very, very nervous when CDR, carbon dioxide removal, is baked in. And even the sense of, like, you know, even if we did capture it, then we'd store it. I mean, my God, I mean, we have such a huge propensity to go to war and drop bombs on things. There would be a chance in 50 years or 100 years, you know, that there would be a huge carbon bomb set off of one generation's entire stored carbon. So it's, as you may be able to hear, it worries me.
Sure, there's so much to unpack there. It's a great question. I might begin with that comparison between maybe the Wright brothers and CDR. Let's focus on CDR. Look, it's true that aviation as a technological stream parallels military, because World War One and World War Two accelerated the development. And yes, they use bombs. And when we use airplanes, it causes pollution and so on. So what's interesting about that that innovation is that, like most of the innovations we have in our civilization, they're actually exothermic. They consume organic carbon as fossil fuels. They oxidize that fuel in a chemical reaction to release heat, energy, and carbon dioxide. Now, that particular thermodynamic process is actually characteristic of most of the innovations that we've had in human history. Now, the point is that when we come to this CDR problem, which is a new industry, it doesn't kind of really exist except in a seminal way, it has the opposite thermodynamics. And this is why it's difficult. Now, if you have a process that's endothermic, you've got to put energy in, i.e. energy in to take carbon out the atmosphere. One of the key problems it has is that because of the energy cost, it is often and generally unprofitable. So the cost can be quite high. And then who's going to pay for it? Like, if I said to you, I've got this great way to take carbon out the atmosphere, it only costs $50 a ton. Will you lend me $50 billion or give me $50 billion and I'll start sequestering? You probably say, no, actually, I want that $50 billion. I want to invest it, make a profit, and take a big holiday. Now, that's the issue. You see, an industry such as CDR, the reason it hasn't got going yet is because it runs on a business model that effectively requires grants. In some ways, it could make a profit if it produced materials that are saleable, but generally it requires grants. And that's why it's underfunded and we don't see a lot of research and development. Now, that's why the global carbon reward is so important. It flips that equation and provides debt-free grants at scale. Once that comes into the economy, that particular problem can be taken care of. Now, in general, I have heard people say that the amount of money that we actually invest in R&D, that's in general, is actually quite low. It might seem like civilization does a lot of R&D, but on average, it's not that high. So if we up the investment rate on R&D, like significantly, we'll have many more breakthroughs and much more quickly. Also, we do need to acknowledge that even under the current rate of investment, there are major breakthroughs happening all over the world in material science to produce new kinds of batteries, batteries that don't need lithium. There's new battery technologies that use materials like sulfur that's in huge abundance. So that's the kind of technology that can make breakthroughs. However, there is a lag time between the material science discovery and putting it into production, say as a new battery. So experts say that when you have a new technology that's looking promising, it can take 10 to 20 years to have it scale up with industrial processes. Now, that's in the existing economic paradigm. But if we introduce a carbon reward, I think those research to delivery timeframes can be shrunk down. And this is really the name of the game. It's how to speed things up. I don't take the pessimistic perspective on technology. If we're going to invest literally trillions of dollars into CDR, we can get results. And it's worth thinking about from the point of view that if you look at our planet, what do you notice? Two-thirds of it is water, seawater. And if we could find and develop technologies to biosequester carbon through the oceans, that's a lot of surface area that theoretically, at least, we could use to absorb CO2 and try and solve this problem. It would also potentially help deacidify the oceans. So I'm all for giving it a try, because if we don't, the consequences are, to me, are pretty obvious. There's no way out of this problem.
I agree with you. I just want to challenge that frame that I think that I don't consider myself to be technologically pessimistic. I consider myself to be technologically realistic at this time. And I think that's important, I think. When a technology currently isn't being deployed at scale, doesn't work at scale, and when we don't have the political will to even manage our, political relationships for longer than a couple of months, then, as I said, big risks involved in capturing things and storing them under the ground. It's the same reason that people are afraid of nuclear waste lying around for a couple of hundred years. But let's go back. Okay, so create an institution under the UN, which would then create a digital carbon asset, call it a carbon coin, that would be the carrot to accelerate and reward actual carbon reductions. And then you said it would be the central bank that could distribute this, central banks around the world?
No, not quite. We need a new institution. We can give it any name we like, but it could be called something like the Carbon Exchange Authority or the Carbon Climate Fund or something like that. But it would be a UN institution, and it issues the digital currency, carbon coin. The role of central banks is to buy the carbon currency only whenever the value of that currency is too low. So there will be a schedule of rising value over a rolling 100-year period. And the central banks simply buy it up whenever its exchange rate falls below that floor price. The rising floor price, is really where the magic happens.
So what is a floor? Yeah.
Not sure.
Yeah, I think you might have to slow down and explain some of these things for me. Yeah. Like, why would the exchange rate fall? And what is a rising floor price?
Okay. Now, let's consider that when we talk about value, in this case, we're talking about the value of a carbon currency, but we could be talking about the value of a cup of coffee or a banana or another currency. To express value, you actually need to compare one thing with another thing. And so the way currencies are valued is by comparing them as exchange rates. So you might compare the carbon currency with the US dollar or with the euro or any other currency. And those currency pairs are what are communicated in the foreign exchange currency market. It's all about these currency pairs. So what we're doing is saying we don't want that value, say relative to the US dollar, to fall below a minimum value, which we simply call a floor. So the value or exchange rate can rise above it, but not fall below it. So once you set this floor, and if you have the floor rising over time, what that implies is that the carbon currency becomes investable. It's an asset that you can buy with limited risk. And so any investor can buy it knowing that they're very likely to earn a profit if they sell it in the future. So it'd be a highly liquid, secure financial asset. Now, this is very important, actually, because it's through this mechanism that we attract the private sector to actually buy the currency. And thus, the cost of mitigation is actually transferred into the private sector as savings and investments into the carbon currency. So those people who are listening and maybe pay close attention to the economics of climate change. Many institutions have said that governments don't have enough money to pay for this transition. A lot of the investing has to come from the private sector. And so this is a mechanism for mobilizing that private wealth directly into mitigation. Now, that idea...
Sorry. Mm-hmm. I haven't quite followed that. So this institution issues these assets and would Correct. Give these coins to people who have achieved absolute reductions in carbon emissions. But it would also be, it's also an asset that would be traded. And so it would be bought by the private sector.
Yes.
And investors. How would them in buying, and but when they buy it, what does that mean, that suddenly there's more or its value goes up and therefore there's less carbon coin per emission reduction?
No, it simply means that it changes hands and the value of that currency or carbon coin is changing depending on supply and demand. So what might simplify this discussion is if we think about carbon credits, when people buy carbon credits, they're taking a claim on the carbon for offsetting, often. In this model, that's not possible. The carbon is retired and nobody gets access to carbon offsetting through this approach. There's no offsetting. So they're only just trading an asset. You know, like anything, think of Bitcoin or think of silver coins or, I don't know, shares for Apple or something like that. So it's just basically like that. It has a value based on what people are prepared to pay for it. And
I just don't understand how that means that then it's the private sector that's essentially funding all of this mitigation research and deployment by making this saving. That's a bit I don't understand.
Right. Look, what I'll do is I'll just slip in another idea which may either confuse you or it might help answer the question. But
wild card.
Wild card. There is another policy that exists called cap and trade. And you probably heard of it, the European Union's emissions trading schemes, a cap and trade. And so in cap and trade, what the economists say is that we'll set a cap on emissions and that cap is converted into pollution permits. And those permits are given to polluters or auctioned to polluters. And then they can trade them with each other, depending on whether they need more permits or they have a surplus of permits. So in the world of climate change, economics, and all that blah, blah about carbon pricing, there's a theory there. The theory is that when the polluters can trade their emissions permits, they reach what's called a Pareto optimal outcome under the Coase theorem. Now, what it's basically saying, it's a fancy way of saying simply that the polluters are happy because they can trade their permits and pay what they want and sell them for what they want. By analogy, it's a bit like lining up to see a movie and everyone has a ticket, and then some people want to go in first and some people want to go in last, or first class, second, third class. And so people will pay more or less for that privilege. And then everyone's happy, in theory, kind of like a Pareto optimum. So in this case, we're flipping it over. We're saying we have mitigation being paid for. We issue the asset, the carbon currency, to the mitigators. Then the mitigators can trade it with the world, and the private sector can buy it, and people will trade in it in any way they want till they're happy. And that's how the price is created. However, there is a difference here. It's a subtle difference, could be a bit technical. With the central banks, what's happening is that they are actually representing the public. Basically, the banks are representing humanity and saying, look, we are going to trade as well, but we're going to set this floor price. Why? Because if we don't set the floor, we're fucked. Because you got to have that floor rising to get a high enough price to decarbonize quickly enough to avoid some kind of tipping point or catastrophe. And ideally, we'd set that price to target the amount of carbon removal and conventional mitigation that we need. So it is a little tricky to understand, but I could explain it in other ways if you like.
No, I think that that analogy, or that, sorry, that other example, it did help. Surprisingly, it did help.
Right.
But I just want to know, has that pollution credit resulted in less pollution in Europe?
It has. It has worked. One of the problems with the cap and trade schemes in the world is that at the beginning, governments generally tend to be a bit soft on the market, oversupply the permits. Now, the value of those permits has increased to around 50 to 100 euros a ton. It just depends on how much energy is being produced from coal, gas, et cetera, or renewables. And that changes depending on geopolitics and supply demand. Now, that actually is an interesting point, that the value of those emissions permits and carbon credits is hard to predict. But in this policy, we remove that uncertainty by having this guaranteed floor that we know it's going to rise over a very long period of time. That's critically important. Remember, in our discussion, we were talking about research and development. So imagine you're an investor and you're interested in getting into the CDR market to remove carbon using some marine method. You know you're going to have to pile in maybe a few hundred million to make a profit, and that includes research and development and so on. Are you going to do that if there's no guaranteed price 20 years into the future? That's a big gamble. But with this guaranteed reward, those risks are kind of taken away, because the investors know if, as long as they get the right technologies that are scalable, they can compute, if you like, how much profit they can make. So it becomes a manageable industry. Actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to use a metaphor, because
please,
if we get into this nitty-gritty about the financial mechanism, which is the kind of details that economists like to talk about, but if we go a bit higher to a high-level understanding, what is this all about, really? What are we trying to do at the macroeconomic level with this reward? What I claim is that what we're doing is setting up a control system to self-regulate the flows of energy and resources in civilization. So I use a metaphor. The metaphor is based on the idea that an electric vehicle or a hybrid vehicle represents our civilization. So this alludes to the problems you're talking about. Now, in the metaphor, the hybrid vehicle or electric vehicle, it's going down a hill and it's going faster and faster. And it's getting it too fast because it starts to become dangerous going too fast. So the driver, that's the policymaker, if you like, wants to figure out how to slow the vehicle down. Too much growth, too much unsustainable growth. So the traditional thinking is that you put your foot on the brake and you take your other foot off the accelerator, and that will slow the vehicle down. Now, that could be degrowth, actually. Fairly instinctive reaction, degrowth. The problem with that in the real world is that degrowth will be highly destabilizing for the financial system, and it won't solicit cooperation. It'll probably do the opposite. It'll cause some sort of chaotic outcome. There is an alternative in the metaphor. And what you do is you install another drivetrain where you take the kinetic energy of the vehicle and you convert it into power that runs from the engine to a battery. So the wheels are spinning and they're turning a generator, electrical generator, and it's powering up the battery, and that slows down the vehicle. This is called regenerative braking. So what you're doing is you're taking the problem and you're converting it to do useful work, which is to charge up the battery. Now, what does that mean in the real world? Well, the metaphor is that we got to divert a lot of our activity, whether it's clean or dirty, into decarbonization. And when you do that, you're crowding out other kinds of activity, particularly consumption. And as you do that, you actually slow down consumptive growth through this kind of regenerative braking that's focused on mitigation and carbon removal. And that's kind of a systems analysis of the problem-solution paradigm.
I think that metaphor is really, really useful, because to extend it to an absurd degree, you cannot install that second drivetrain whilst the car is moving. You need to stop the car and get a team of engineers and put it all together and then get back in the car and start driving again. And to me, it's a really accurate representation of where we are now, which seems to be nobody quite knows how to stop the car, even if they wanted to. Nobody quite knows. The system is systems function in and of themselves. They are the sum of their components and the relationship between those components. No one government has enough muscle to dramatically shift this system of unsustainable growth. There would need to be mass cooperation, which the system is built against. And so I think this is why, you know, people sort of seem to say, well, it's going to be degrowth one way or the other. Either planned degrowth, which is very, very difficult to imagine, or it's going to be we're going to crash into a wall and there's going to be a huge financial recession, let alone the planetary impact of that. So I understand what you're saying, that this reward is essentially like paying for the most highly skilled team of engineers ever to run along beside the car at the same time and, you know, build in that second drivetrain whilst it's still moving. And I agree that in a system that is built for profit, then adding a for-profit incentive is fundamentally the best way to get people's attention. I suppose, given the other perverse incentives that are built into this financial, political, economic, energy system, I mean, what would stop, for example, what would stop fossil fuel companies using their extraordinary profits to buy these coins, hoard them, for example, to attempt to crash that, or how do I put this? For those that have the money to keep going at a loss, and I know that that's sort of a paradoxical statement, but when we factor in all of the government subsidies that aren't changing direction, I mean, is this not predicated anyway on, what am I trying to say? Is this not predicated on there being no perverse incentives anyway, which we know there are in the system?
I think the system we have, call it capitalism if you like, global capitalism, there are a lot of perverse incentives in the system. Maybe one example is the use of incentives to fund fossil fuel industries around the world. I think cash incentives are something like $500 billion a year into that sector.
Yeah.
Do you think it would work? I ask myself, will governments remove those subsidies in the next few years? I seriously doubt it.
No.
Now, we have a major problem with fossil fuels, and that is the world collectively, through government planning and so on, is planning to extract more than double that would be allowed for 1.5 degrees. I think even much more than double. And so what that's saying is that we're definitely not on track and we need a structural reform to address that particular problem. Now, I'll just quickly explain what would happen with the carbon reward, global carbon reward. Essentially, what would happen is we would do a stock take of all of the coal, oil, and natural gas in the world and create a priority list. At the top of the list, the highest priority would be those resources that are found in biodiversity hotspots, in tropical rainforests and other environmentally sensitive areas, particularly areas in developing countries where there are communities that are vulnerable to pollution and so on. And then we would offer the reward to the owners of those leases, particularly in developing countries, and buy them out. So the owners would receive carbon currency, which is bankable. It's equivalent to hard currency. It's highly valuable. And we can offer a good price, something equivalent to the profit on that license. However, in the policy, they have to also accept a contract where they're obliged to take that finance and invest most of it into renewable energy projects. And the reason is we need to substitute that fossil energy with cleaner energy. We can't simply stop the supply of fossil fuels because if you're making energy scarce, fossil fuel scarce, the price will rise. And that's kind of a rebound effect that will drive even more exploration and extraction somewhere else. So by using the same policy to produce more renewables and to strategically use those renewables to decarbonize those sectors that traditionally use fossil fuels, what we're doing is we're tackling the problem at both ends. We're reducing the supply of fossil fuels and we're reducing the demand for fossil fuels in roughly the same rates globally. And this is very important because it's through this mechanism that we can stabilize energy prices, particularly fossil fuel prices. Once you have some capacity to stabilize those fossil fuel prices, you'll get buy-in from fossil fuel exporting countries because that's what they want.
Can you explain to me again why having them sign a contract that would ask them to spend most of that money, that yes. GCR that they've received on renewable would stabilize the price of fossil fuels? I just didn't quite follow that bit.
Yes. So, well, first of all, maybe we should look at it just at the first level before going on to that quite nuanced topic. But in developing countries in particular, it's often said that they have a lot of trouble raising financial capital at reasonable rates of interest. So charges on loans to the developing world are often 10% higher than the rest of the world. Maybe not that high, but significantly higher. So they have trouble raising financial capital because of sovereign risk and other issues. Now, by offering them this reward, they have hard currency value, which is actually debt-free. There's no loan. So it helps them to solve that financing problem. It means they're not as indebted. It helps them solve their debt problem, which is a major part of neo-colonialism, if you like, in the modern world.
But the lease owners for most, you are making an important point about neocolonialism and debt bondage, but most lease owners of fossil fuel mines, whatever, plants, everything, fossil fuel exploration, even all of these licenses, they don't belong to people in the global south.
Typically, they belong to the government, and the government will sell the leases to private enterprise. Or they might nationalize the resources and extract them themselves. So when the resource is sold for carbon currency, the resource is still there. It doesn't really change hands so much, but they're obliged not to extract it.
Okay. So you're talking at that first level, at like giving debt-free GCR, huge chunk of money to... countries around the global south, states around the global south, who do not extract their
paying them resources. Not to extract. There's a good example. Ecuador tried this. They didn't raise the money they needed. But the Ecuadorian example in Asuni National Park is this the perfect example. If you listen to African diplomats and pundits, they often say that the reason they're extracting fossil fuels is they need the revenue. They want to develop. And why should they stay poor? Since the global north is extracting, consuming fossil fuels, why can't they? Because they hardly consume any. Now, we want to allow them to escape that fossil fuel trap, to leapfrog the industrial revolution, in effect. And so that's what this will do. You're giving them what they want, which is debt-free, hard currency finance. But you're saying, look, don't worry about the extraction of fossil fuels. Go straight to renewables or something similar and build it out in a way that's going to benefit your country, your society. It doesn't have to be utility always. It can be highly decentralized. It could be small solar panels on people's houses, biofuel installations, and it can be utility scale, and it can be in other countries in the region. So those companies or governments will own those assets, and they can earn income on that over the long term because it's their asset. And so that's what the Energy Asset Exchange does.
That sounds great. I guess one alarm bell sort of ringing off is that I imagine most coal mines or oil deposits, gas deposits, the ones that we know of are being explored, and a nation will often already be in a contractual relationship with a private company, often a company from the global north, in order to do the exploration and exploitation of these resources. Especially given the recent massive drive in more exploration around the world. And there is a fifth arm of the World Bank, the Investor State Dispute Settlement, by which private companies take states to court for loss of profits. And so I guess, that seems really good. If a state has a resource that hasn't been leased out to anybody else, then yes, I can totally see how that works. But a huge amount of these resources are already in this kind of like negotiation pipeline between state and corporation. And they could possibly risk themselves up to being sued for reneging on contracts, which is why a huge amount of nothing happens around the world when countries change government, and swing from left to right.
Yes, I understand what you're saying. So we might describe this problem as stranded assets. So for example, I like to use the example of coal-fired power plants and coal mining. And you make a very good point. There are trade rules probably that say, you know, if you break your contracts with a coal-fired power plant or something like that, they'll sue you. You know, these are international trade agreements. Now, if you take the perspective of the owners of the coal-fired power plant and the suppliers of coal, in this simple example, at the end of the day, what they're looking for are profits. So that's a ongoing relationship you want to break. You want to break that dirty cycle. So there's a fleet of coal-fired power plants that ideally we would retire early. But how do you do that? Well, one way, if it's necessary, is to buy them out with carbon currency. So what you do is you go to the coal-fired power plant and you find that price point where they're willing to accept that payout to retire them early. And so they'll take that windfall, and under contract, they have to build out renewable energy infrastructure. For the coal supplier, it's a similar deal. We'd have to buy them out, but they, in their contract, they would have to take a lot of that revenue and invest it into the renewables as well. This is the only way I could see to break the cycle and at the same time prevent this buildup of stranded assets. Now, personally, I don't care about the stranded assets, but the owners of them do. And if we have the accumulation of a large pool of stranded assets, keep in mind what we said earlier, how countries and governments are planning to over-extract. That's a lot of assets with imputed value. Somebody owns it and expects a return. And all of those people are not going to give up on that profit opportunity easily. So we'd have to buy them out. I think I've explained the process of energy asset exchanges with a couple examples. So maybe I'll just leave it at that. But if you need another example, we could come up with one.
No, I understand the model, I think. And thank you for giving different examples and being patient with me. I suppose it's pasting it onto the mechanisms of this world, which are built on neocolonial power hierarchies, which are built on huge amounts of corporate control, which is another way for states essentially to extend their long arm through economic colonization. And I suppose anything that challenges that capacity as well is surely going to be met with resistance by this system. And I have to say another thing I've been thinking of is, given the increasing political instability that we are seeing, asking people to sign a contract and say, okay, but now you have to, you know, do X with your money, doesn't mean that they will. When I was reporting on Malaysia, for example, they regularly under a different government would provide absolutely mind-bogglingly false data on their deforestation and reforestation rates to the United Nations because they just didn't give a fuck, quite frankly. And they could make, and also they were doing things like deforesting and then selling carbon credits in deforested areas. And that's sort of this problem, I think, when we use the financial market as the main tool. There's a lot of space, there's a lot of divorce happening there between material reality and how we can conceptualize that reality. And it allows for a lot of corruption. And I suppose that's kind of, this is why I'm hopefully gently pushing back on a model that is really interesting.
It's an important question.
Yeah.
So I'll speak to that as well. In carbon markets, there's a well-known problem that people are cheating in a sense with carbon credits and offsetting that's not really backed up by real carbon sequestration in forests, for example, especially forests. The reason that's such a big problem is that forest and land use is particularly difficult to monitor regularly, because they're in remote locations and there's not a lot of infrastructure and trees, you know, it's a lot of variability in scientific data that needs to be collected. But if you come back to the example of the coal-fired power plants, they're pretty easy to see, and you can tell if they're working or not working. So when companies plan to run a coal-fired power plant or a coal mine, they don't sort of do it half in, half out, because this infrastructure is very large and well-planned. They're either going to be in or out. There's not sort of a halfway in between. And for example, if a coal-fired power plant was half in use instead of being shut down, you could see the smoke coming out and it would be obvious. You can see if a coal mine is being operated or not. So you can inspect and verify quite readily. Land use and reforestation, deforestation and avoided deforestation and so on, that's somewhat different because the nature of the data is particularly demanding. And there's another problem with that market, and that is you have the projects, then you have the verifiers, you got the credit brokers, and then you got the buyers of the credits to do offsetting. That system is really set up for corruption, because when you have a buyer, all they want to know is that they've bought a carbon credit to offset. And once they've made the purchase, that's all they want to know about. They don't really want to know if the credit is going to be the best credit in the world for the next 100 years. The broker certainly doesn't want to know, because the broker's made their profit in the initial sale, and they're not going to invest the time and money to monitor the projects for the next 100 years. Why? Because it eats into their profit. So you created the system, or they created the system that is ripe for corruption. In the global carbon reward, we don't have that arrangement. What we have is this international organization that issues the currency, does the long-term MRV periodically, in perpetuity, really. They're long-term contracts. Measurement, reporting, and verification. Okay. So the contract is between this UN body and the project directly. The contract is evergreen. It goes for 100 years rolling, more or less. And they have to report periodically and reassess their entire carbon balance every year or 2 or 3 years, whatever makes sense. So if they have material problems, such as forest fires or illegal logging, that gets reported. And then they have to pay back the excess carbon currency. So there are consequences in this system over the long term. You don't just get a free ride. You have to keep your account up to date based on what you've actually avoided or sequestered. So that's how that system works. And the authority has no interest in scamming the system, because all the people in that organization are paid on salaries. They don't take commissions.
I mean, in my work as an investigative journalist, someone somewhere always has an interest in scamming the system.
It's true.
Someone somewhere always wants more than what is on the table, and always wants more in comparison to the next person. So, but
we've
got to
get you. We've got to get you into the organization to do the investigations.
Just got an image of having the entire thing up on a wall, just throwing darts at different, you know, possible. This is what an arsehole can think about doing with this bit.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. People do game things all the time. It's human nature. Yeah.
Well, it's sort of, you know, the nature of people who are brought up in an economically perverse system, I think.
Yeah. But the carbon credit market, though, maybe you've heard in the media, The Guardian did some articles. Whether they're accurate or not is one thing, but they are claiming that as much as 80 or 90% of carbon credits in some standards are faulty or greenwashed.
Yeah.
That's a very low bar. If we could get to 80 or 90%, I think we're doing pretty well. That's 80 to 90% real, as opposed to greenwashed. Yeah. So to flip the coin over, that's where we would be. And that's probably good enough.
Yeah. In with regards to distributing, we're 80 to 90% real GCR.
Yes. Well, right. There is a diminishing returns on trying to get to 95, 98, 99% perfect accuracy because data is never perfect. So, you know, this is an 80-20 rule that a lot of people use. Go for 80% real and allow 20% errors. Now, you can factor that into the whole policy as well by adjusting the targets macro in a macro sense. So there are ways to compensate for a certain amount of corruption, a certain amount of mismanagement and data error, because that will always exist.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have some questions about pricing and knock-on impacts of implementing the GCR. So, for example, what if Ecuador received a big, you know, hundreds of millions in this hard currency, this global carbon reward, and then because it starts getting traded on the market, what happens is, okay, I've got so many different questions in my head and I think I might have already answered this one. I think this might not be a question, but what happens if the United States of America just goes around and starts buying up, you know, all of that currency and keeping it for themselves, essentially? Would that be a problem?
No, in fact, it would be good. This might sound a bit strange, but if oil exporting countries, if the mafia, if criminals, if anybody bought this currency because they just want it, instead of Bitcoin, for example, it would be good for the planet.
Right.
And the reason is it's channeling the cost of mitigation out of stakeholders into the hands of private investors. Now, I'm not saying that we should encourage criminal activity. I'm just saying, you know, in the extreme case, it doesn't really matter who buys it. As long as people are free to buy it. In a more realistic and well-governed policy, what we would try to do is allow citizens, households everywhere, including in the developing world, to be able to trade this currency. By the way, it's not a medium of exchange. It's purely an asset. You can't buy stuff with it. But allow everybody in the world to be able to buy it on their smartphone. And the reasons are multiple. One is, it gives the little people, the poor people, an opportunity to invest and save. As opposed to being restricted to their local currency, this carbon coin or carbon currency will gives them more security and it's highly liquid. And they'll be able to buy it in small amounts.
Yeah.
Now, that actually could be a policy that we give individuals first option to buy it because of the benefits as an investment. There's another indirect benefit, particularly in middle-class households, say in the developed world, and that is if people like you and I do buy it, it means our savings rate could be increasing. If we increase our savings rate, we reduce consumption. And this is actually meeting one of the requirements of degrowth. Except it's doing it in a different way. So degrowth as a concept, which I don't agree with, by the way, it's just the way it's done is not necessarily right in the original idea of degrowth. See, the problem with degrowth, in my opinion, is they're trying to force it onto the global financial system, which I don't think will work. Degrowth done from a grassroots perspective, bottom up through community actions and lifestyle choices, that's perfectly fine. I fully support that. But we need something more intelligent to manage the world economy. And I argue it's increasing the savings rate because that will take money away from regular consumption and put it into effectively what we need, which is investing in mitigation technologies, as we discussed earlier, CDR and conventional emissions reductions, And we talked about, remember we talked about research and development, all that's so incredibly important.
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose the degrowth pushback would be that the top 1% emit as much as the bottom 50%. So we do also have an inherent sort of class problem here. And if the top 1% have enough money that they don't need to add to their savings, and their consumptive rates are through the roof, and we're not putting a cap on them essentially at any point, then they are endangering, you know, the rest of the planet, which is why a model for forced redistribution, I think, is looking increasingly necessary at this time, because if there just simply aren't enough carrots to give, then you're going to start using a stick.
Yes, I think you have a good point. I wouldn't say that the global carbon reward, which is a carrot, is the complete answer. What the smart thing to do is, in my opinion, is to follow, in a sense, those experiments. Remember, we talked about the game theory experiments. Mm. You begin with carrots. You have a very coherent global carrot to get everything moving. That changes the politics. It changes the way people think about the problem. And as you have more liquidity and more profit opportunities in the world economy through mitigation, it will shift the Overton window on sticks as well. Because when people experience profit motive and careers and a lifestyle and livelihoods based on mitigation, what happens, in my opinion, is it embodies into society a new morality. It says it's moral to mitigate, decarbonize, because look, we make a profit, it's good for the planet. In that new moral landscape, that's when you can bring in more sticks. It's not until you offer businesses a financial, positive financial incentive to decarbonize, can you actually also bring in sticks? Because if you only bring in the sticks, straight away businesses understand it's going to cost them and it'll eat into their profits. So they won't necessarily accept sticks first. This has always been the issue, I think, with carbon taxes globally.
Yeah, I hear you. I would argue that people that don't have enough long-term vision to look 10 years into the future to understand that their business models are fundamentally at danger from an ever increasingly unstable planet should not be leading this transition in any way. We need those people far, far, far away from the levers of power, because either they are stupid, willfully ignorant, or deliberately deceptive.
But isn't that the definition of a politician?
It shouldn't be. And it shouldn't be the definition of any leader, politician, business leader, nothing. And I understand that according to system dynamics, these people have forces acting upon them. But the point of being a leader is being able to act against those forces anyway and usher in new change.
You're a utopian when it comes to politics, perhaps, because I'm not optimistic about politicians for the reason that they are representing the wealthy class, usually.
Yeah.
And private enterprise generally follows the profits. It doesn't sacrifice itself for the environment. Yeah. So we have to kind of accept that there's some dynamics there behind the scenes. But that's my worldview. Maybe I'm a bit cynical.
No, I think that's very realistic. I think that's totally realistic. And I understand why you would want to create a model that speaks to those people in their language. Mm. I suppose for me, my fear around that is, but I don't want those people to still be setting the terms of debate and quote unquote progress in the future, because they are the people that fundamentally mismanaged this crisis and come from the class of people that fundamentally mismanaged this crisis for the past 50 years.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, interesting. Of course, we're going to talk about the global carbon reward. Maybe I talk about it too much, but
no.
In its operation, government actually doesn't have much to do with it, because the Carbon Exchange Authority, or the UN organization, it's in charge of all the technical work and issuing the currency. The central banks there provide that guarantee, the support for that rising floor price. And government doesn't really have a role other than collecting taxes. Also, maybe signing off on an international agreement and giving their central banks a mandate to support the policy. But once that's done, the beauty actually is for government. Government doesn't have to worry so much about mitigation or the funding of it. And this is why I think governments might find this policy interesting. You see, if you're in government and you have to manage the national budget, the fiscal budget, there's always massive competition for that money and you're allocating spending. When it comes to climate, you know it's expensive and it's a political topic. So when the carbon reward comes into play, from the government's perspective, it doesn't cost them anything because we're monetizing the cost. As businesses within their jurisdiction earn the carbon reward, their revenues are increasing potentially, and that means more tax revenue back to the government. So the government can see the positives and it doesn't have to directly fund the policy.
Yeah, I see that. My other question on prices would be, how do you stop then a price spike in the materials necessary for a decarbonized energy system?
You know, prices will change and they will potentially spike. That is an unfortunate reality of our planet. Mother Nature has only given us so much resources to play around with. So if something incredibly valuable and useful, let's say lithium, is in finite supply, when it becomes scarce, prices will rise. Now, that's kind of inflation. That's cost push inflation due to resource constraint. The only way out of that dilemma is to substitute the lithium with something else, or just let the high prices dictate forced austerity. Now, one of the problems of that kind of inflation is that with rising prices for lithium, it could also drive more unsustainable extraction. That's a risk. I don't have an answer for that directly, but the policy does have a mechanism to preferentially finance projects that are more sustainable and more regenerative for ecosystems and communities. This is another layer for the policy where the actual rewards that are paid are going to be weighted so that projects that are more sustainable for communities and ecosystems will be weighted higher, and then those that produce harms will be weighted down. So we will essentially redistribute wealth to encourage positive co-benefits. This is not a perfect system, but it's likely the best we could hope for.
I'm just thinking if, say, Ecuador again gets, $4 billion in hard currency, GCR, in order to deploy renewable, in order to not use the fossil reserves and in order to deploy renewable infrastructure. They then depend on a whole world of supply chains and materials, most of which will be coming from outside of their borders. If Ecuador is not an early adopter of GCR, say that they have gotten their GCR payment at around the same time that many, many other countries have, and so we are seeing these price spikes, could that not then see the global south then priced out of a renewable energy transition for not having enough money to deploy that energy infrastructure?
That's a very perceptive question. The policy is by design flexible for this particular example. It's called Rule 1, the Cleaner Energy Rule, and it's based on flexible pricing. The reason it's flexible is that the price points will be different for different industries and different through time. So just like you said, if there's cost push inflation, resource constraints, and the reward has to rise, it will rise.
So they will always get more money.
Yeah, to keep up with the problem. Yeah.
So it's not a one-off payment.
No. It's quite flexible to adjust for those price points. You could call it cost effectiveness, if you like. That's the technical name. Now, people might ask, or they might be thinking, hold on, if we keep offering more and more money for projects that decarbonize, will this drive inflation? And the answer is yes, there is a kind of inflation built in. And that's when resources become scarce. However, that has to be looked at through the context of what we're avoiding, which is worse. Do you want inflation on certain kinds of resources, say lithium, for example, versus another kind of inflation where the climate is becoming so disrupted that you can't buy a loaf of bread because the wheat crop failed that year? You know, they're the choices. So it's a trade-off. What we're doing is we are averting a systemic risk that's positive feedbacks in climate systems, tipping points and cascading impacts because of Earth systems becoming unstable. That's a risk. That brings with it huge inflationary costs and scarcity if the climate system becomes irreversibly destabilized. So that's a tragedy without no end. The alternative is to decarbonize where there are these resource constraints and costs, and prices will adjust. Now, one of the benefits of rising prices for, say, lithium is that what happens, it makes alternatives more economic. So, for example, I know there are technologies that people have invented for batteries that run on sulfur and other elements that don't require lithium, and they work pretty well. In fact, they might not be as good as lithium batteries, but at some point, the ability to substitute with abundant resources much more cheaply, it becomes the better option. And in a sense, this is why prices are quite a powerful phenomena in the economy. They kind of bring about a natural justice. Not always, but there's an inbuilt logic to prices in the marketplace.
Is there, though? I mean, we have a society in which you can pay, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds for something like a diamond, which has no inherent value or use whatsoever. It's still in a world that is, you know, in crisis, if not on the brink of, you know, ever worsening crises. Like, I just don't buy into this economic theory that prices are somewhat rational. I see irrational prices around me every damn day.
I think, you know, I'm not a trained economist, by the way. And you talked about diamonds. There's this beautiful little story about why are diamonds so valuable and water so cheap when you can't live without water? And the answer is prices are determined at the margin. So diamonds are very scarce. After you buy your first few diamonds, you don't really need more. And once you get your first glass of water, you know, you don't need a million gallons. So it's scarcity which creates these prices, or lack of scarcity. Now, I'm not saying that prices are inherently moral. What I'm saying is that our problem with prices and the economy is actually thermodynamic. If we want to survive on this planet with a stable climate and stable biosphere, you got to manage the stocks and flows of resources and energy to realize a certain carbon balance that can avoid systemic change to the climate, catastrophic change. And you also need to be able to manage the carbon cycle to be regenerative. This is why I said earlier that this policy, it's not simply about concentration of CO2 and methane in the atmosphere. It's about the whole carbon cycle. So inbuilt into the policy is the notion that we actually want to regenerate the living portion of the carbon cycle, the biosphere, as much as possible, and communities. Because if you don't have coherent, stable communities that can regenerate and coherent, stable ecosystems, those stores of carbon will eventually become unstable. So, for example, if you have a society that breaks down, you know, law and governance breaks down, you might end up with violence and confusion and an inability to maintain public services, and that could release huge amounts of carbon. You never know. Similarly, with ecosystems, if you take out keystone species in the food web can collapse and the ecosystem can collapse. And that can also release huge amounts of carbon. So we need to broaden our horizon about what actually we are talking about. It's the living carbon cycle as well as the concentration of gases in the atmosphere. This is why I think the model makes sense, because it is analogous to the photosynthesis respiration model in the way the stocks and flows are set up to create what actually, I know this is technical, but to create a control system out of these subsystems. So I'm all for control system theory. It's not really discussed in this important topic, which is quite alarming, because if we want to manage the global carbon cycle, we have to go to control system theory. There's no other way, in my opinion. Control systems are proven, and they have a thermodynamic construct. So they can work. You just got to get the design right. So that was a very high-level comment from me. Sorry if I'm taking the conversation on a tangent, but I just wanted to set that context at a very, very high level.
Yeah. Tell me, you were at COP, the most recent one, and you gave a presentation on this, if I am correct. How was it received?
Well, I was very lucky to be invited into COP. The Bhutan Pavilion actually got me in. The reason I mention that is that our project is existing on very modest funding at this stage. So we need all the help we can get. And I was lucky I was able to present three times. The policy was well received. However, I don't have big audiences because people don't really understand policy or know about it. It's not until we find some major partners to begin the policy demonstration and really giving it a high profile. Not until that happens, I won't be able to attract large audiences. I think it will eventually get there because we need it. But if anybody's watching who'd like to support this project, I do encourage you to reach out and help us so we can get to the other COP meetings and spread the word.
I'll put links in the show notes for contact, website, and all that kind of stuff. Delton, this has been really, really interesting. My final question for you is, who would you like to platform?
Wow. I know some people in Switzerland who are starting up a carbon coin of their own, carbon currency. It's not the same model as Global Carbon Reward, but I think we should give them a plug because they are putting it out there in the real world. And the currency is called Toko. And I think the person you want to speak to is Paul. I just can't remember his last name at this time.
That's all right. Paul? I'll look it up. This has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much. And thank you for your patience explaining a couple of things multiple times. Really appreciate it.
It was such a pleasure. And I hope it was interesting for you and the audience. And if anybody has a question, please reach out.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you want to learn more, I've put links to everything over on planetcritical.com, where you can subscribe to support this podcast and read the weekly newsletter inspired by each interview. If you liked this episode, leave a review and share it far and wide. If you loved it, choose a paid subscription at planetcritical.com to join the community. As always, my deepest thanks to that community. Planet Critical wouldn't exist without your support. Thank you, everyone, for listening and for coming on this journey together.